All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and our next guest is the great Tom Englehart, a.k.a. Tom Editor, a.k.a. Tom Dispatch. TomDispatch.com is the website, and of course, we pretty much cloned the whole thing at original.antiwar.com/Englehart, and that means you get all of Tom's great articles, as well as those of all of his in-house writers there, with a great introduction by Tom pretty much each time. Original.antiwar.com/Englehart. And if you go to TomDispatch.com, you can see the link right there to Tom's new book, The United States of Fear. And if you donate to Tom Dispatch, you get one too. That ain't so bad. You can get it in ebook or the regular kind. All right. Welcome back to the show, Tom. How are you?
Good to see you, Scott. Fine. Or hear you, anyway.
Yeah, well, close enough. You wouldn't want to look. No, all right. So here's the thing. I was just sort of guessing, proverbially throwing darts in the dark, and I thought, you know who probably has some interesting things to say about the end of the Iraq War would be Tom Englehart. And now, it's kind of a cardinal rule of this show. I pretty much only interview people about a thing they wrote that I want to question them about. But this time, I'm pretty confident that you're going to have all kinds of wise things to say about it. Maybe I could prompt you a little bit if you could maybe describe for the people how you see it, how we got into this war in the first place, this war in Iraq. Because it was kind of abnormal for a start of a war to say, we're going to war a year in advance, and then going to war.
Oh, you're so right. But you know what I'd actually first like to focus on is the getting out, because I want to, you know, I was struck by something. I live in New York City. My hometown paper, the New York Times, had a piece on the last unit to leave Iraq. And this tells us something about, you know, it tells you something about beginning the war when you end it this way. I mean, what's really happened? The last unit to leave left Iraq at like 2:30 in the morning, in the dark. And before they left, according to the Times, they sent their interpreters out to the Iraqis they had been working with, the Iraqi military people and so on and so forth, to make appointments for the next day. I mean, in other words, the last unit to leave Iraq from this glorious war of ours snuck out in the middle of the night, leaving the Iraqis they had been working with, not with a goodbye or anything else, but with the thought that they would wake up the next morning and see the Americans, and they weren't there. I mean, I think if you want to talk about a symbol of, here are two words that you just don't see right now connected to Iraq, but are accurate, a debacle and a defeat. You know, the U.S. has now slunk out of Iraq with its tail between its legs. I mean, this is the story of Iraq, 9 years later, something like that. And, of course, you know, the getting in was to be glorious. The reality of getting into Iraq was the Bush administration was convinced, and not unreasonably, that to use an old image of Mao Zedong's, that Saddam Hussein's Iraq was a paper tiger. And there was a classic word that they used for the campaign they were about to have. There was a guy named Adelman who was one of these neocon supporters, and he wrote in the Washington Post. He said beforehand, he said it was going to be a cakewalk. Now. And they knew that Saddam's military was incredibly weak, that it would collapse, that it could be crushed, and they were right. It was functionally, I mean, I don't want to say it was, you know, I'm sure there was some tough sledding, but basically, functionally, it was a cakewalk. They imagined that the beginning of this war, that this was just going to be the start. This was Iraq was just to be. It wasn't the last stop, as it turned out to be. It was the first stop. Once we were in Iraq, they already had plans on the table for giant military bases, which they built, you know, huge American towns, you know, the largest of them surrounded by 27 miles of, you know, barbed wire and walls and so on and so forth. I mean, all of these now left behind. They would be greeted as liberators. They would put troops a la South Korea, 30,000 to 40,000 of them in until the end of time. They would be right in the heart of the oil lands of the Middle East, and of course Syria would be in a crunch between Israel and U.S. the U.S. and Iraq. It would go down. The Iranians, of course, they would be in a crunch between the U.S. in Afghanistan and the U.S. in Iraq. They would go down. I mean, the neocon joke at the time, the quip was something like everybody wants to go to Baghdad, the Iraqi capital. Real men want to go to Tehran. This was what they thought. They thought this was the beginning of what was going to be, I mean, no two ways about it, it was going to be Pax Americana. We were going to have the greater Middle East. I mean, we would reorder the world. I mean, this was really what they thought. And they were kind of visionaries. They just were mad visionaries, but that's what they were. That was the beginning of the war. We went in, remember, shock and awe. We sent our cruise missiles in and our planes, actually got none of the Iraqi leadership, not one, but killed, according to Human Rights Watch, dozens of Iraqi civilians. That was the beginning, of course, the nightmare for Iraqis. And that was really where it began. It began in dreams of in delusional dreams of glory, and it's ended with us slinking out, but in this country claiming that it was, you know, a stalemate, that we stabilized Iraq. I mean, and so on. I mean we've certainly made it sound slightly more glorious. Nobody says defeat. Nobody says debacle. Very few. I mean, a few critics like us, but not many. You know, your guy Ron Paul would say it was a defeat. He wouldn't even blink. You know, but most of them, they're playing a different game. But it is a defeat, a debacle, really a kind of catastrophe for everybody, including, of course, the Iraqis.
Well, yeah, of course, the Iraqis the most. But, you know, one of the real ironical things about this is, and, you know, maybe this, you know, obviously Cheney was one of the hawks in 91, and probably, I don't know, maybe you know specifically whether he said go all the way to Baghdad then or whatever, but there's a great clip that
he
was unearthed that many people have seen. It was sort of the tongue clucked around the world, where there's Dick Cheney at the American Enterprise Institute in 1994 rationalizing why the Bush senior regime did not go all the way to Baghdad in 1991.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is because, well, the majority would be in line with Iran, and the Sunni factions might be more aligned with the Syrians, and then you'll have problems with the Kurds, and there's, of course, Kurdish movements in Syria and Turkey and everywhere else that could cause a problem, and it basically we would have been occupying a hostile land with no good end to it, and it would be basically impossible to try to build up a new what we want in the place of Saddam, and so we decided it wasn't worth it. In fact, in previous years, he had used the language that how many more American soldiers' lives is Saddam worth? Not very damn many. And so this shouldn't be done. But then somehow, do I have this right, Tom?
Oh, yeah,
Ahmed Chalabi came
in
and convinced him that it's going to be fine. We'll build a pipeline to Haifa and we'll overturn the Iranian regime from there, and it'll work instead of what you already know.
Yep. Well, I think they were pre-convinced. I don't even think they needed Chalabi. I mean, I think that, you know, before they took the government in 2000, they set up something that was kind of unique in our history. They you know, a bunch of these guys, including Cheney, set up PNAC. It was the Project for a New American Century. That was
right,
like
rebuilding America's defenses.
Yep, and it was probably the first administration in waiting masquerading as a think tank. You know, and from the moment they did that, they were ready to go into, I mean, they wanted to go into Iraq. They saw us change. I mean, and Cheney had changed his mind and his tune. He had between 91 and 97. Of course, we also have to go back a little earlier as well and remember that the weird part of this whole story, or part of the weird part of an endlessly weird story, is that before Saddam wasn't our guy, he was our guy. And before we accused him of being a monster, you know, dedicated to aggressive war in Kuwait, we supported him in, he invaded Iran, which was our enemy, you know, what was back in, what, 80 and 1980, and we supported that, you know, we supported
him. Well, and even when he invaded Kuwait, April Glaspie, the American ambassador, sure didn't try very hard to talk him out of it anyway.
Exactly, we were.
And I'm sorry, we'll have to hold it right there, Tom, and go out and take this break.
Yep.
But when we get back, we'll get more wisdom about the horrible, good-for-nothing Iraq war that I'm not going to let you all forget as long as you keep tuning in here, no matter how bad you want to. All right, y'all, it's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with the great Tom Englehart, Tom Dispatch, Tom Editor, author of The United States of Fear. Yeah, that's what we all have in common. That's what makes us Americans. We're deathly afraid of at least something. All right. The website, again, is tomdispatch.com. We're talking about Iraq. Tom, you have the floor.
Yeah, you know what I was thinking about? Well, the in the intermission, I was, as far as the Iraq debacle, I was thinking of a couple of other things. One was, you know, when we go to war, when we went to war in Iraq, I mean, we went planning to stay. And one of the striking things about that is we moved everything in with us. it's done now, but they had to reverse engineer all of this stuff. So the U.S. military had to move 2 million items. I mean, this ranges from computers to porta potties, body armor to whatever, out of Iraq. You know, 2 million items. It was about 20,000 truckloads of stuff. And then they left piles behind. They left maybe $600 million worth, it's estimated, behind for, just gave it to the Iraqis. Of course, we've also given the Iraqis these huge bases that we built. I mean, only as we were leaving did we even know how many there were, ranging from little combat outposts on up. There were, at the height of our building excesses, there were 505 American bases built in Iraq. That's the official figure we have now. During the war years, the figures we got were maybe more than 300 or something like that. I mean, this is like a staggering way to not just make war, but spend money. And the other thing to keep in mind is that while all of our money went into this catastrophe, and we left tons of it behind, we're not done. You know, I mean, it is true. The military is really largely, except for the, a very small contingents in the embassy, out. But we have this gigantic embassy left behind. I mean, it's ridiculous to even call it an embassy. We still call it an embassy. We built a billion-dollar embassy, giant cost overruns. That was the story of the war. It's in the middle of Baghdad, twice the White House compound, the size, they always say, of Vatican City, of the Vatican. We are now going to have, I mean, I've seen various estimates, but somewhere between 15 or 16 and 18,000 people in this mission. Now, obviously, just a few of them are diplomats. Of those, 5,000 odd are armed mercenaries, hire guns, and thousands more are the privatized part of the military, you know, what used to be the military, but now, you know, the people who are going to clean, cook, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There are military missions. There are undoubtedly plenty of spooks. We don't know exactly who's been left behind there. The mercenaries are heavily armed. They've got their own little air force. It's not an army. I don't think it functions that way. But it's a staggering leftover disaster. That embassy is going to cost $3.8 billion. To operate and do its programs supposedly for the Iraqis next year. $3.8 billion. I mean, this is staggering stuff. And of course, out of that embassy, they're also going to be selling the Iraqis piles of weapons, you know, $5 or $6 billion in F-16s. Thank you, Lockheed Martin. So somebody at least made something off this war, and so on and so forth. But it's an enormous, you could leave behind, an embassy, you know, 50 people or 100 people, whatever it is. They could do visas and whatever, but we're leaving this giant thing behind. It's not actually big enough to do anything significant, but it's big enough to create, to cause further trouble for us in Iraq, to make the Iraq war in some unpleasant way continue. It's like they just can't quite give up. It's a very strange thing. I mean, this is like the strange ending of a disaster.
Well, it seems to me that embassy is really a scary place, because, of course, it was put there under the assumption, like you're saying, that they were going to have all these giant permanent bases forever. Now they're holding on to the one last base, Hillary Clinton's State Department
base,
a detachment of Marines and some mercenaries that you can't trust farther than you can throw. They're kind of risking it, occupying that thing there in the center of Baghdad, if you ask me.
I think they are. I think it's an actual risk, and I think it also represents the degree to which in these years everything about the U.S. government, everything, that's an exaggeration, but significant things about the U.S. government were militarized, including the State Department. I mean, if you now read, I mean, the other day, for instance, we're never tired of warlike activities. So the Obama administration is now, having gotten out of Iraq, is now pivoting to look at that new enemy, which was also the old enemy, it was the Bush administration enemy before 9/11 hit, and that's China. So they're pivoting to a new Pacific policy, you know, building up military in the Pacific and so on and so forth. I read Hillary Clinton did a piece, an endless piece filled with euphemisms. And, you know, I mean, I wouldn't recommend anybody read it, but it was in Foreign Policy magazine. But I found it interesting largely because when you read this thing, and particularly read to the end, it's hard to imagine. This is the Secretary of State. The thing reads like it's being written by the Secretary of Defense. You know, she's talking about bringing Navy littoral ships to, that's littoral, not literal, to Singapore and military missions to the Philippines. It's all military. I mean, the degree to which in these years this country really has in some strange, utterly strange way been further militarized is almost hard to figure out. I mean,
I was just reading another one this morning about the militarization of the cops, where they really are like the right-wing paramilitary forces of all our puppet dictatorships around the world now. Every local sheriff's got an M16 and full combat fatigues and body armor and whatever. If they don't wear them all day, every day, at least they have a team of cops like that every day. And they all have it at the ready, and they got tanks and everything else.
Tanks, yes, tanks. That was what I was going to say. They've now bought, they're tank-like vehicles with, you know, guns.
Yeah, armored personnel carriers.
And, you know, we're not talking about, you know, I mean, we're talking about right in the heartland of the United States. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. You know, I mean, it was just like watching that, the pepper spraying of those kids in Davis. I mean, that was a situation that could have been handled by one cop.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but, and this isn't like, we're not there. I mean, the striking thing about that Davis thing, when you look at it, is that these aren't even the police. These are campus cops. In my day, campus cops, they didn't even wear uniforms. They certainly didn't wear any kind of weaponry. They let you into your room if you got locked out, or if you were, in my day, they still had parietal hours. So if you were past parietal hours, you got in trouble. But that was what a campus cop did. Now they go in, they've got tasers, they've got pepper spray, they've got, you know, I don't know, you know, those guys have some kind of weaponry. It might have been tear gas. I couldn't tell which. But I mean, they're gun.
But again, I mean, this is all because of the decade of war. That's what's led us to the situation where they're treating little towns in the Bay Area like it's, you know, downtown Fallujah's, because they've been through Fallujah. They've done this. And this kind of goes back to me. The most important part of this sort of is just how unnecessary this was, and just how obvious it was to anybody who wanted to be critical that they were lying us into war. They announced in January of 2002, the policies regime change, we're going to feed you whatever crap we have to convince you to do this thing, and we're doing it. And then, you know, the aluminum tubes had been debunked in the Washington Post, of all places, in September of 2002. The whole thing was a bunch of lies, a pack of lies. Anyone who wanted to could see it. Hell, half the population was against it in the whole run-up to the war. They knew better than the other half. None of this had to happen. 1 million dead over there. 5 million refugees. 4,500 dead Americans. Uncounted wounded on both sides must be in the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands, Tom.
You know, and at the heart of my new book, The United States of Fear, is, I mean, when we think of these now up-armored police and so on and so forth, is the fact that fear, and fear of only one thing. There are plenty of things to be scared of, for Americans to be scared of in our world, right, in our American world, but only one thing were we supposed to be scared of, and that was terror. And based on the fear of terror, I mean, from these ridiculous wars to everything else, they have funded themselves. The national, what I call the national security complex, has funded itself, and so have local police departments, the military, et cetera, et cetera. It has been like fear has been like a cash machine. It's like fear was the ATM of these 10 years, and fear just of you know, largely, you know, an organization. This is Al Qaeda, that in its best days, long gone, could commit a major operation every couple of years, no more. I mean, this was crazy. It was totally crazy, you know?
Yep.
There were dangers, but not this.
Right. All right, y'all. That's the great Tom Englehart, tomdispatch.com, original.antiwar.com/Englehart, and check out his new book. You can get it, the electronic version or the other kind, The United States of Fear. It's at tomdispatch.com. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Scott. Bye.